Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined today not by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton, who is, as mentioned, celebrating the wedding for which he took some time off last year, finally able to have that party he wanted and deserved with his family and loved ones. And so here in his stead is a man who once bought himself a lifetime's worth of goodwill from me, now doubling down on that, having once brought me a sandwich to a World Series game, no less. one of the Athletics' national baseball writers, and someone with whom I would say I stand inside the Venn diagram, the little sliver in the middle of the Venn diagram of people with documented expertise in sandwiches, people with documented expertise in baseball, and people with spectacular hair. Mr. Eno Saris. Eno, thank you. Thanks for coming on.
That was an A-plus introduction. I don't think I've ever had the likes of that. Thank you very much. I'm ready to go.
again, thanks for that sandwich. Anything you need at this point. You brought me a sandwich and you've come on the podcast, so I appreciate it.
Oh man, that was I think that place is shut down. That was like maybe some sort of roast beef or
I remember it was a good sandwich. I remember it was like a very California-y sandwich. It was on like it was on like a hearty sliced bread. Whole wheat sliced bread, which feels more like I feel like in New York you get like more toward the roll hero type sandwiches on the East Coast, and West Coast, it's more open season with bread selection.
we have a bread out here, Dutch Crunch, that y'all don't even use at all.
Yeah, we don't know about it yet. We have there's Buffalo has Weck, which is like particular to that city. There are regional, I think like the Kaiser roll culture is very much a New York thing.
That is true. I used really to love my breakfast sandwiches on the Kaiser roll.
Yeah, it's a great sandwich roll. We'll talk a little bit more about sandwiches later, but this is this is nominally a Mets podcast, and the Mets are coming off taking 2 out of 3 from the Reds Monday night after playing 2 wild games in Pittsburgh. They go ahead and play perhaps the wildest game I've ever seen in my life, winning 15-11. They lose Tuesday, get a huge start from Marcus Stroman on Wednesday with the bullpen overtaxed. But Eno writes nationally, and I don't want to, get into the nuts and bolts of the Mets so much as I want to look at some of the trends that have been going on across the big stories across the league this year. And the biggest one, I think, is sort of twofold, involving the baseball and the sticky stuff has obviously sort of taken the fore. I think it's like a sexier story to talk about, but fundamentally, I think it's hard to talk about the sticky tough without talking about the ball itself, which has changed a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I think around the time that we got StatCast, there were some changes made to the process by which the ball was created in Costa Rica. And those changes produced more aerodynamic ball, a ball with less drag. And baseball at first, I remember asking Rod Manfred about this in something like 2015, at a combined BBWA luncheon, and he laughed at me, told some jokes at my expense, classic Manfred, and tried to pretend like there was nothing there and that there were more home runs being hit because teams were hitting power hitters at the top of the lineup now.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. And like, and Freddie Galvis hit like 30 home runs one year, right? Like that is clearly not what was happening. And I think people tried to, and a lot of people, and there's maybe some truth to it. A lot of people said, well, it's launch angle. All these guys are now swinging for the fences. And I think, and it's something we've talked about, like, I think that guys are sort of selling out for power to the extent that they have to guess a little bit on pitches. And so you'd rather, if you're going to guess, you might as well swing hard as you freaking can at that. And so I think there is something to that, but, certainly the baseball has changed. It seems like a couple of times this time they at least said they were changing the baseball.
That's right. And so 2019, we had, you know, a kind of a nadir or an apex. You know, we just had the most aerodynamic ball of all time. And we had this huge homer explosion, broke all the records. And I think they wanted to step back from that. So they sort of released a memo internally, which they knew would be leaked. It was basically a way to tell everybody, hey, we're changing the ball. This time it's on purpose. We're deadening the inside. However, they also lightened the ball. They made the ball a few grams lighter. And although that was within the range of specifications, it was as light as they could make the ball without getting the rules committee involved. So there was kind of this meaningful thing there where they made the ball lighter, and they didn't, if they'd made it like 0.1 gram lighter, they would have had to get a lot more people involved.
And so if you're unfamiliar, the specifications for the baseball are not precise. They're given it because the baseball is handmade and it's in this sort of old-timey process where it's like sort of shrouded in secrecy in Costa Rica. And so rather than say like the baseball should be exactly this size and exactly this weight and exactly this whatever, it's sort of a range of, and it's a narrow range, but it's a range nonetheless. And when you're dealing with a game of millimeters like baseball, a very, very subtle difference to the ball can make a very, very big difference in how the ball performs.
Right. And so this year, we've seen some of the drag come back, which and then the core was deadened, as they said, so there's less bounce to it. And so we've seen home runs come down. But with the fact that the ball is lighter, we've also seen velocities go up across the league. So people are throwing the lighter ball harder. The more drag means more movement, and that was contributing to strikeouts. And so therefore, and I cannot say this with any reporting behind it, but we can report the timeline, which is the ball changed. We had 6 no hitters in the first month. Mm-hmm. You know, 7 is the record. We had the highest strikeout rate of all time, almost over 25% for the first time ever. And we had a few hitters saying, oh, what about Pine Tar? We had my piece about, you know, how people are doing Pine Tar, and they had been having an effort of, let's say, let's take the pine tar out of the pitcher's hands. Pitchers are using pine tar to up the spin rate and get more strikeouts. I think this is where the ball and the pine tar come together. Why did they do enforcement in the middle of the season? Because the ball, the run environment, the baseball they created with the new ball was not exactly what they wanted. That's how I see it. Because why otherwise would you up enforcement in the middle of the season? Why else would you take pitchers' pants off in the middle of the season?
It feels like the law of unintended consequences has just like keeps coming up in this situation, because the sticky self itself was, you know, initially it sort of sounded like, and you know, Tim and I have talked about this too, like it, for so long it was just something that everyone accepted that pitchers did, and hitters seemed like they were largely
cool. And the ball
cool
is
with,
slick and right, it's fine. Yeah,
Exactly. And then it turned out, well, wait a minute, it depends on what sticky substance you use. And if you use this, if you use this one, then obviously, you know, spider tack, we all know, has a huge effect. And this is something you've looked at quite a bit as well.
Well, and it's like, I think it's a natural consequence too of like, okay, so we have rosin, that's fine. Sunscreen and rosin, that was the Red Sox back in the day.
Clay Buchholz putting it on in the sky, in the dome. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we all saw that. So we all sort of laughed about it. Some people got really angry on Twitter, but nothing really happened out of it.
Which is like, that's true of just about everything. It's like some people got really angry on Twitter, but nothing happened.
But also, we live in a baseball of data and tech now. And so if you saw that on TV and you were a young pitcher, you might say, oh, well, I've got this Rapsodo here and I've got some pine tar here because it's a baseball thing. And I've got some sunscreen. Let me just try all these and see what the Rapsodo. Oh, wow. Oh, right. Wow. That gave me an extra 100 RPM. Oh, this other thing. And so, you know, some people started boiling down Coca-Cola. One pitcher told me he used bong resin. There was a CBD oil rumor going around. Everyone was trying the sticky stuff and putting it on their fingers and seeing what would come out of the Rapsodo, basically like a slot machine. And some of our research said that like you would get something like plus 400 to 500 RPM out of nothing to Spider Tac, the difference there. And plus 500
RPM. So what type
RPM,
of, yeah, tell me what that means.
Sort of theoretical. You know, that's okay. The ball doesn't take a minute to fly to home plate, so it's not like it's revolving 500 more times, you know. But when, you know, I have a stat called stuff, which just takes a look at spin, you know, rates and axis and movement and velocity, and just tries to say how good is this pitch by stuff, not location or command or any of that stuff. So mm-hmm. basically, giving someone 500 RPM can increase their fastball stuff by sort of 10 to 15% and their breaking ball stuff by like 25 to 30%.
So
we're talking about augmenting your breaking ball by a third.
And what has happened since they started enforcing it in the middle of June? June 21st, I think, was the day they started stripping the pitchers on the mound. What have you seen since that date?
Two-thirds of baseball is down what you would call statistically significant in terms of RPM.
Mm-hmm.
So two-thirds of baseball was doing something, and maybe more, because there's obviously probably still some people finding a way to cheat or finding a way to use the stuff. And then about a quarter of baseball is down like sort of 300 RPM plus, where you would be saying that they were using like Spider Tac. You know, that's not too far from what we got anecdotally when we were doing the research on these pieces. We got sort of 75% for using anything and 30 to 40% for using the harder core stuff. So, right in that wheelhouse. In terms of what has happened to the game, mm-hmm. it's been a little bit more muted than people might expect. But we've lost about 1% of off the strikeout rate, and we've gained about 1% of walk rate. And homers
so
are
there
up,
is,
but homers
so there is
go
something
up.
Maybe to the grip being useful.
Yeah, there was something
control.
To the whole
yeah.
command thing. It's for command. There was something to that, yeah. Pitchers were right in the end on some level.
And homers are up.
Yeah, and then today or yesterday I had a piece about how this has injury implications too, because mm-hmm. you have to grip the ball a little bit tighter if it's not attached to your fingers.
Right.
And gripping anything tighter is going to lead to more fatigue. More fatigue leads to injury. So that's something that we may see in the future. There was a bit of an injury bump in the data after the enforcement.
Yeah, that feels like a tougher one to certainly to quantify, just because
or
pitchers
to draw the line straight through.
Yeah, pitchers get hurt at such a high rate anyway. Like, and they're always everybody's, you know, and like this is not to doubt Tyler Glasnow, who was like very candid that you wrote about it in the article. Mm-hmm. Glasnow basically came out and said this is because I can't use sticky stuff that I got a partial tear of my UCL, but. I do think it is such a hot button topic this year that there will be instances of guys who were going to hurt themselves one way or the other who will just say, well, this is because I can't use sticky stuff, right? Like that feels like
maybe.
Yeah.
But I also think it's fair to say why in the middle of the season, which is why I brought it up in the
Absolutely.
Context of the ball changing, because in the middle of the season, you give nobody a chance to change up their routine to no, like to even throw a bullpen, you know. I mean, it was so fast. They leaked that these checks were coming, and they basically said next week these checks are coming.
And that's a good way to get us to the Mets a little bit, because I think one of the guys that if Tim wrote about this a little bit and we talked about it a little bit, but a guy who has seen a pretty sharp decline in his spin rate and his command and his results. Having blown now three consecutive save opportunities. And look, there's always going to be some rough stretches of a season for any reliever, guys pitching in very short outings, guys who get worked a lot might get tired. But Edwin Diaz has had a really, really rough go of it since that enforcement began. Is it fair? Is it safe to say that there has been some sort of change there in how he's has to go about his business?
Yeah, I mean he's down in that sort of down that 300 RPM kind of territory where you can't help but raise an eyebrow. I'm not someone who's sort of beating my chest about, you know, quote unquote, you know, cheating with the capital
not,
C. Because
you can't because it's ridiculous because
the
league didn't enforce it.
For
they
so long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and people should say the same thing about steroids. Different conversation. People right. are, I think, a little bit angrier still about steroids. But
that
same
one also,
thing.
Steroids is a little bit different because there's health implications, you know, mm-hmm. for people. This
right.
is like
yeah.
some pine tar on your finger. There's no health implications.
That's true.
But Diaz, and it's interesting because here's another link between the Mets and the Yankees. Nobody wants to hear this. The Mets and the Yankees have basically the same record. Have basically the same run differential, have basically the same projection going forward. It's just the context around them are totally
right.
different.
Yeah.
But both of their closers are down big in spin rate, and both of their closers have poor command traditionally, and both of their closers are struggling even more with that command right now. So, you know, it's anecdotal because you're kind of putting all these pieces together, and yes, Diaz could come out the other side. And it's interesting that not everyone on this list of people whose spin rate has really dropped has gone into the tank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, there are sort of movement and performance differences that you can spot in this group. Yes. But not everyone is in the tank like Diaz right now, you know, and relievers kind of live in small sample size. So I'm not saying that Chapman and Diaz are done.
Right, and that's what I was gonna ask. There, have you seen any evidence yet that there is like a way out of this for guys? Is there? And it's probably too soon to tell because it's really only been a month. But has any guy, has anyone seemed to find some of that spin or perhaps some efficacy elsewhere in adjusting to this change?
Well, this is interesting. Diaz's spin is climbing back up. After the first initial drop, and there are pitching coaches that tell me that there are things that you can do to harness spin better. There's stuff that you can do to turn spin into movement better. Spin efficiency is a big thing that pitching coaches talk about. So you could either just become more efficient with the spin you have, or you could, I don't know what these mechanical adjustments are, but some pitching coaches tell me you can create a little bit of spin, with different mechanical adjustments. And then there's just the adjustment that I wanted them to be able to do in the off season, which is just like, how do I pitch like this?
Right.
Let me refine, because he's been living at that spin level for 5 years. So like where, you know, how do I pitch? What did I pitch like before? You know? So I think there's that adjustment that's happening right now for both of them. For what it's worth, like Diaz had a whole season that was like this, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, last year he was not good, and he chalked it up to not having his right entrance music coming into home games.
I did
games.
Not hear that.
And you know, if you hear the song that he goes with, you would completely understand. It is called "Narco." It is by the, I believe, they're Danish big house techno outfit.
Interesting.
Blaster Jacks with a guy named Timmy Trumpet, and it sounds, I have described it before, it sounds like it is the start of a bullfight in the future is the only it sounds
nice.
Like a futuristic, like someone is fighting a robotic future bull under strobe lights.
Well,
and it is the coolest song. I do not doubt at all that not having that song failed to provide him the adrenaline he needed to be an elite closer. So I don't think that's about the spin rate. I think that's
all
just
right. Well, maybe he just needs a couple energy drinks and one of those they have a thing they call velo slaps. Have you ever seen this?
I don't know that. No.
A velo slap is where you slap yourself really hard in the back of the head.
And that's to get your velocity up?
Yeah.
Because Roger Clemens, in addition to whatever else Roger Clemens did, famously put Icy Hot on an especially sensitive area
yes.
of the male body.
This is the same idea
was
as the
then
velo
like,
slap.
Was reportedly snarling like a bull when he got out on the mound. It's several bovine references in this conversation.
Well, I just think that the ins and outs of bullpens is why and this is the thing the Yankees have done forever is build the best bullpen you can, have as many guys as you can have back there that are good, and then you can kind of move guys in and out. So if Trevor May needs to take a couple opportunities, I mean, you've seen over on the Yankees side, they've retreated from Chapman in some opportunities and used other guys. You don't have to say they're out of the role. You just have to kind of give them a chance to strike three guys out in one appearance or something and feel like they're back on the bull.
Right, right. You would think like a nice outing against the Pirates might cure what ails you, but you would be wrong.
Didn't work out that way.
Did not work.
The good news is you've got Trevor May. I wish that Lugo was at his best right now. Between sort of May and Castro, maybe, and I guess Familia,
Familia's been good. Yeah. The bullpen has been good all year. It's been, they've gotten really lucky in that, like, every guy has had a rough stretch, but it's been like each guy has,
but
had
not
his own,
all of them at the same time.
Yeah. Each guy has had, like, there was a while when May couldn't get anybody out, and there's a while when Familia couldn't get it, you know, and Castro.
Exactly my theory of relief. And so I think that, you know, as much as they could probably get away with not getting a reliever at the deadline, it probably still makes sense for them to get a pitcher at the deadline. I was looking at a crazy idea maybe of Trevor Story and Michael Givens.
That would be cool. I mean, I think that would be either. What would that cost? That would cost a lot, right?
I don't think so. They're rentals.
That's true. Wait, is Givens a rental too? Because he's been around.
Yes, they're both rentals. So they both are up at the end of the season. There aren't a lot of. I think you'd be competing basically with the Oakland Athletics, and maybe the Dodgers. But I don't think the Dodgers. The Dodgers will be like, well, we're fine at shortstop, so we're not going to give you much. So I you know, and then actually coming up with a name that would leave the Mets is fraught with concern, because then people will just yell at you, I love that guy, I hate that guy, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't think it would take it would not take Alvarez. You know, everybody wants to hold on to Francisco Alvarez, the best prospect in the Mets system, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course. You can't give up. You have to only give up your crappy prospects, right? That's how it works. Just the guys.
Well,
I was
trying to find
the
intersection of good. Good and like also not best prospect, maybe like JT Ginn or something. Ginn?
That's a guy. I'm not as up to speed as most on the Mets, but I kind of just,
he's like an A ball guy with good numbers that is not in the top 100 prospects. The Rockies could say he's a pitcher. You'd then maybe add a couple other guys who are further down the list.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are Mets fans out there who would be, you know, standing on the Triborough Bridge if they traded Ronnie Mauricio. Ronnie Mauricio is a 20-year-old in A-ball who's not having the best season. Not to like doom his future or anything. It's just what people tend to, you know, wildly overvalue their team's best prospects.
It's true, but I do think that like most teams will try to keep their top two prospects, top two, three. If you look at what the Padres have done, they traded away so many prospects, but they've always tried to hold on to their top two or three.
Yeah.
And so I think that, I'm not saying that anybody's untouchable, but for the Mets, if they were to trade Mauricio or Alvarez, they would get somebody back that would be here for a while. Would be on the team for a while. So I'd
like
more of
like the Berrios type situation.
Yes. Yeah. If they got Berrios and some people are saying Buxton, if they can't sign him, the Berrios Buxton combination, that would require one of their top prospects. But
be worth it.
That's what's coming next week. I would say that infield help. I mean, I've watched a little. Guillorme had like the three error game.
Yeah, but he's fine defensively. I don't think anyone's that worried about that. It's just like how well will his bat hold up with everyday play.
And VR is not. I wouldn't really want to play VR over Guillorme, I don't think, at short, just from what I know of them. So maybe an infield bat, an up the middle bat that's a rental, and then an arm. But it is interesting that like this team has flaws, but I don't think that any of them is like immediately fixable by a trade deadline acquisition.
Right. It's just like they kind of need to be better. They definitely have a need in the back end of the starting rotation because they've had so many injuries there, but they also have this like sort of
Carrasco and Syndergaard coming back at some point.
At some point. But Carrasco's been a couple weeks away since April. So it's hard to really count on him at this point. And Syndergaard, you know, when it seemed like he was approaching readiness, they got shut down. So hard to bet on either of those guys.
One last parallel, and this is, I'm sorry to listeners that hate the Yankees, but one last parallel is if you build a team, a veteran team, this is the peril, right, of mm-hmm. a veteran team. The peril is that older players get hurt more often.
Right.
And it's just less likely that you're going to keep everyone in one piece the whole way through. And the way that you try to upend that is by either using great player development to continue a pipeline of usable players, or by some combination of player development and player acquisition where you just always think about depth. And honestly, I think the Yankees' plan for the most part is good. They just, you know, Frazier didn't hit, you know. And for the Mets, I think the question is, you know, will these veterans like Pilar and VR,
right?
Will they be good enough in these stretches when they're needed to be? And it seems like they're getting healthy. Other than Lindor, they're getting healthy. McNeil needs to get going. And now yeah, they've got their full outfield out there.
They scored 25 runs in the 3-game series against the Reds. I think that is the offense that a lot of people were hoping for at the beginning of the year. When you look down and Dom Smith or someone good is hitting in the bottom half of the lineup, it's a good feeling for a National League team. And
yeah.
If and when, and it does sound like Lindor will be back at some point. It's not, we know obliques can linger, but when he returns, if they can stay healthy, I think the lineup is very good. Maybe they could use an extra bat. Everybody could use an extra bat. There's talk of Chris Bryant. There's talk of Javi Baez. You mentioned Trevor Story. All guys that would certainly be upgrades at the right cost. But I think it seems like the back end of the starting rotation is where there's the most pressing need.
Yeah. Well, John Gray is a rental too.
That
so
would be fun.
The Rockies seem like they should be on the phone with the Rockies a lot. The nice thing for them, though, is that in terms of run differential, in terms of strength of opposition within the division, the Braves had the best run differential and had the best shot of pushing them and just lost their best player. So, you know, I know they're going to give a shot at it. But the other three teams have negative run differentials and are projected to basically do that going forward. So
yeah, and the Mets have a chance. So they've got three against the Blue Jays coming up at home, and then five in 4 days against the Braves. And we've said this before about their series this season, but that's a series I see as like, this is a chance to, if you take 4 out of 5 from the Braves the day before the trade deadline, you essentially kill the Braves season.
Right before the J deadline too, so you stop them from spending any more capital on acquiring players.
We typically take questions at the end of the show. Before we do, I just real quick, you mentioned your stats stuff, and you had an article about the pitchers who have gotten better from April, May to June and July, and I was amazed to see one name on there. Because I didn't think it was possible he could get better from April, May. Jacob DeGrom got better. His stuff got better.
Yeah, and I wish it wasn't like this. Stuff is a bit of a black box, and I understand that. But the thing that makes stuff so hard is to measure and to figure out is that these things interact, right? And so when I'm looking at what made DeGrom better, I think it might be the fact that his fastball wasn't as fast, but his slider did not get slower.
Mm-hmm. And so it's like they're even. It's like almost like that fastball changeup differential where there's like the optimal difference.
Yes, and so you know, velocity differential off the fastball is a big component of stuff, and that doesn't mean that you know big is good for every pitch or small is good for every pitch. It's different for every pitch, but fastball differential is big. And I think for breaking balls, it's actually you want a smaller differential off of your breaking ball. If you think about the best breaking balls in the league, a lot of them are really hard curve balls like Lance McCullers or Craig Kimbrell, right? In which case they have a lot of drop and they're super hard. They're like throw them 87 miles an hour. That's crazy. Or you have a lot of these really hard sliders that like DeGrom throws. DeGrom, I think, has the best slider by stuff plus in baseball. And so I think it is just that sort of relationship between the pitches changed a little bit as his four-seam velocity came down. But I think in the end, you'd rather have the four-seam velocity high because that just sort of makes everything harder on the hitter.
We've got a baseball question and a sandwich question. We'll do them quick. The first one comes from Adam. It's the baseball question. It's an impossible one. He says, I currently have Nimmo, Dom Smith, and Michael Conforto on my fantasy team, but I need to drop one of them going into the second half. What do you think about the second half prospects for the Mets outfield?
Yeah, and it is kind of amazing that the projections say that basically all of these guys are going to hit 250. And Dom and Conforto are going to hit 10 homers and not steal many bases. And Nimmo is going to hit 6 homers and steal 4 bases. They're actually fairly interchangeable.
Yeah, it's amazing offensively.
They're very different players. Mm-hmm.
It's three completely different hitters who Nimmo gets on base a ton, but it doesn't have as much power. Yeah. Smith's a good contact hitter, doesn't strike out as much as Conforto, but he doesn't have quite as much power as Conforto. Conforto has the most power of the three, and then you balance it all out. If you look at something like OPS Plus, which is fairly simple and straightforward at this point, they're the same. They're basically if you look the last 3 years, they're all right in the 125 to 130 yeah. range. So I don't think there's a right answer or a wrong answer there.
For me, I have a longstanding crush on Michael Conforto.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I started an interview with him with a full straight minute of stats that I loved about his game.
I like that. Yeah. I've hit Mike Trout with that, and he's do you know that you're the best player that there's ever been? And he looked at me for and paused for a while and was like, that's a good guy to be. And I was that's right.
I thought he was going to say, is there a question? I've gotten that one before. What's the question? but I know Smith is out-homered Conforto, but I would expect Conforto to out-homer Smith.
Right.
Going forward. And so I'm going to take Conforto and Nimmo here.
Okay. I'm such a big fan of Dom Smith that it's hard for me to not take him. I think that I would say Conforto has the best second half, but that might be recency bias because he keeps hitting home runs right now. Greg Sasso on Twitter wants to know, this is a big one. How does your sandwich building philosophy change when making a cold versus hot sandwich? Now, this is, I think, a false dichotomy, right? Because we both know that a diversity in temperatures might make for a very good sandwich, have a couple cold things and a couple of hot things. But in generally speaking, if you're incorporating hot ingredients into your sandwich, how does your philosophy change?
I think that my process changes more than my philosophy. I think when I make a sandwich that's basically mostly cold items on maybe toasted bread or something, it's pretty easy to arrange all my cold items and just toast the bread when I need to be ready, right? But when you make something hot, you want the food to be hot when it gets into the sandwich. So you really have to, and also have this thing in my house where the air fryer and the toaster, if they're both on at the same time, will just short out.
Yeah, it's an extra challenge. They should work stuff like that into the cooking shows, I think. Real life scenarios.
You can't use these two things at the same time. But so I really have to be I have to plan it out more. I have to be
strategy.
I need to air fry this to this moment and then stick this in the toaster and then maybe turn on the air fryer for a second to get it warm again or maybe melt the cheese on it after I've got the toast ready. Anyway, it becomes much more involved thing. I don't know if that answers the question. It's more about process than strategy, but
I would say an obvious one is I generally skip lettuce if I'm making a hot salad. You don't want anything that's going to wilt. I also find it makes a big difference in what cheese I select because for me, and I think I'm a little bit more sensitive than a lot of people to this, but cheddar cheese I love, but cheddar cheese hot to me, it just gets so greasy that it's a little bit gross. And so I don't want to melt cheddar on my sandwiches.
Yeah, I think of more provolone and Swiss. And,
mozzarella is a great melting cheese. A softer cheese. I'm a known defender of American cheese as well. Although not really, I don't really make it on a sandwich that much. I just mean on a burger or a grilled cheese. I love just American cheese.
Oh,
That's, you disagree with me, but that's okay.
I just don't.
American
what
cheese
is American cheese?
It's not. It's processed cheese like food. But it's,
okay.
It's amazing.
Is it born of cheddar cheese? It looks like cheddar cheese.
I'm pretty sure it was. And someone can fact check this or not, but I'm pretty sure that like it was Joseph Kraft himself who invented the emulsifying salt necessary to have the cheese melt without losing the grease. So like American cheese was made specifically for better melting quality.
This is amazing.
I think that's true.
This is a lesson.
Don't just act as if that's true.
I will. And the next time I'm gonna melt something, I'm gonna buy some American cheese for it.
It's good. Make a grilled cheese with American cheese versus cheddar cheese, and I think you'll find American cheese better, just because the cheddar cheese it's gonna grease up the bread too much.
It sweats all the grease.
It's true. Eno, thank you so much for joining. Thank everyone. I thank everyone out there for, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I thank everyone out there for listening. If you enjoy the show, as always, please rate, review, subscribe. You can check out Eno's podcast, which he co-hosts Rates and Barrels. What can people expect there?
It's nominally a fantasy podcast twice a week. On Fridays, we have Brit Ciroli in, and it's more of a regular baseball thing. But I've had people tell me, I don't play fantasy, and I listen to your podcast, so I would just expect a bit of a nerdy way into baseball, references to research and data and that sort of way into what's going on in baseball right now.
I think if people are listening to this show, based on the conversations Tim and I generally have, they already have a nerdy way into baseball. So consider the Metrospective like your gateway drug, and you can really mainline it at Rates and Barrels.
Well, thanks so much for your kind words, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Eno, take care.